The Beat Podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only. This episode is specifically for healthcare professionals with an interest in inherited metabolic conditions. Asking the questions in this episode is Dr. James Nurse, a consultant paediatrician.
So welcome to another episode of this educational podcast series on inherited metabolic medicine brought to you by Nutritia. I'm James Nurse, a general paediatrician with an interest in IMD and medical education. And for this episode, I'm joined by an old friend and experienced biochemist, Dr. Rachel Carling. Thank you, Rachel.
Hi, James.
Rachel, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your work and your role within newborn screening and also supporting IMD services.
I'm a consultant clinical scientist at Biopath, which is a private pathology provider in London. I'm also the clinical lead for biochemical sciences and director of one of the English newborn screening laboratories. And I'm the Biopath scientific director at one of their sites. As a lab director, I guess my role is to provide clinical leadership and strategic direction to the lab and to ensure that the service we're providing is high quality, patient focused, and that we're continually improving our service. With respect to the newborn screening role, my role as director is very similar. It's to ensure we're providing a safe, robust, efficient, high-quality screening programme. We screen about 60,000 babies a year in my lab, and every baby is tested for 9 different diseases. So I need to make sure that our routine service is running like clockwork. And in many respects, this should be a walk in the park because we're doing the same tests on every sample. We get roughly the same number of samples every day. We know exactly what we need to do. And for 95% of the babies, it really is plain sailing. But a significant amount of our time and effort goes on the much smaller number of babies who do have abnormal results. And the lab obviously has an important role here because we perform the additional tests on the baby to work out what's going on. So these might be second line screening tests, or they might be the diagnostic tests. And of course, we also liaise with the clinical teams to ensure that these babies are very quickly referred into clinical care. I think one of the other important aspects of the screening director role is that you have to liaise with lots of different external organisations who are involved in the screening pathway. So this is people like commissioners, our regional quality assurance teams, maternity services, the UK Newborn Screening Programme Centre, and also other lab colleagues. And I think we're really lucky in the UK because we have an excellent network of screening labs who work together and support each other.
You mentioned there a positive newborn screen result, and I think for many of the dietitians listening, that's when their involvement with the family might start. For the lab, when that result first comes off the machine and is abnormal, what happens then?
So we tend to run the samples overnight, and so first thing in the morning, the first job of the day will be to come into the laboratory and review the results. If we think that we've got a positive result, then the first thing we do is go back to the original blood spot card and repunch it in duplicate. The lab will prioritise this, so they'll get these retests done as quickly as possible. In fact, we actually have a key performance indicator, which is to report all conditions suspected, or that's what we call the preliminary positive results, to report these results by midday. So as soon as we've double-checked the test result, if it is a positive, we will contact the metabolic consultant who's looking after that baby. And if the results were something like isovaleric acidemia or maple syrup urine disease, or medium chain acyl-CoA dehydrogenase deficiency, these are considered potential clinical emergencies. So the medical consultant we've given the result to will have to immediately contact the family, find out how the baby is doing, and arrange to see the baby in hospital on the same day. And obviously, this has a huge impact on any family. So if you can imagine, you're at home, your newborn baby is maybe 10 or 11 days old, maybe the grandparents have come round to meet the baby, and you think everything is fine, and then suddenly, out of the blue, you get a phone call from a doctor you don't know, from a hospital you might never have heard of, and you're told to bring your baby into hospital urgently. So that our lab screens babies over quite a large area of the country, and so although sometimes the baby will already be unwell and be in hospital, sometimes the baby can be at home. So it's a big deal, and what the lab really doesn't want to do is make a mistake and report a false positive result.
And I mean, those false positives are quite interesting, because when we think we get all this information from the blood spot, we're screening for 9 conditions now, 6 of those are metabolic conditions. But in some ways, with the poor relative of newborn screening, we're not screening as much as we could be. And one of the reasons I think that we've been reluctant is the worry about false positives and that disruption. It's a really difficult balance to draw. How do we find the right compromise?
I think it is very difficult, and I think lots of people have different views on it, and there's quite a lot of patient support groups who have very strong views. As a lab, it's worth saying that we aren't able to make our own decision on this. We have to follow national newborn screening protocol, so it's not down to the laboratory to decide what they're going to screen for. I think my personal view, there's pros and cons of each disorder. I think we can do more, but I think we need to be sure that we're going to do it in the right way. And I think we've got some low-hanging fruit, if you like. So I think the labs could do a little bit more to minimise false positive results. So we could look at introducing second-tier screening tests, for example. So these would be additional tests that we can run on any suspected positive results. So, for example, for maple syrup urine disease, we screen the babies by measuring total leucine. But before we report the result as a positive, because you can get false positive for things like total parenteral nutrition, liver disease, for example, or if you want to be a bit more small print, things like hydroxyproteinemia could also give you false positive. We can test the original blood spot sample for all of the branched chain amino acids, which would include alloisoleucine. And alloisoleucine is diagnostic for MSUD.
And we put a lot of faith in these results, but even between different screening labs, even with the national governance, there can be variation. And that's something that you've been working on, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I feel like I've been working on this for the last 5 years. So I was lucky enough in 2017 to be awarded the Chief Scientific Officer's Knowledge Transfer Partnership. I also think we should be doing other things. So there's a guy from the Mayo called Piero Rinaldo, a very interesting guy, set up a database called CLIA. So it's Collaborative Laboratory Integrated Reports. And he refers to it as precision newborn screening. But what this software does is use multivariate analysis to take different pieces of information that come with a given blood spot. So gestational weight of the baby's age, the baby's sex, the time of the blood spot sample was collected in hours, along with obviously the individual analytical results that we have. And it computes those to give a score for a given baby, which can be used to indicate whether that baby is considered to be at risk of having a suspected disorder. And obviously that is, however you look at it, much more, or it's much more sophisticated than somebody sat in a lab saying, is this above or below a different cutoff value? So one of the other projects I've been working on recently is a national collaboration to retrospectively submit some of the English data into this database to show what a difference it would make to our program if we were able to use CLIA. So I think there are lots of ways we can improve the newborn screening program that we offer. And I think if we can do those first, then we could be much more confident that when we look to introduce another, say, tyrosinemia type 1, for example, another disorder, as we look to introduce those, we could be more confident that we would be able to analytically offer a robust service and be more confident that we wouldn't be generating unnecessary false positive results.
That's obviously something that we want to hear as clinicians, and I think also for the parents. The path to metabolic medicine isn't always a clear one. Why did you choose to work in this field, or do you think it chose you?
I think it probably chose me. I was a bit aimless. I didn't know what I wanted to do career-wise. I left school and did a chemistry degree, and when I finished that, I still didn't know. So I decided that it would be a good idea to do a PhD in analytical chemistry. So I went and measured technetium-99 in seaweed samples with Greenpeace. And then the next step from that was that I started looking at the uptake of this radioisotope into the food chain. And this led to starting to look at the analysis of technetium in blood and urine samples other than seaweed. I was invited to go to a trace metals conference in Denmark towards the end of the second year of my PhD to present some of my work. And at the conference dinner, I was sat next to a couple of guys, got chatting to them, and they told me that they were clinical biochemists in the NHS. This was Ken Newton from Leeds and Andrew Taylor from Frimley. And I'd never heard of a clinical biochemist before then. And they told me all about their job. They told me about the national recruitment program. So when I did get home, I went to visit the lab at Leeds and thought it looked quite interesting. I applied for a training post to start the following year and got a place to train at Leeds. So then I think I was about 2 years into training, and I'd really struggled with an MSc in clinical biochemistry because I had no biology or biochemistry background whatsoever. So to say it was a steep learning curve for me was an understatement. And I think at this point, I was beginning to feel that perhaps the job wasn't for me. And I started to think about a career change. But then luckily I went down to Jimmy's in Leeds for my metabolic biochemistry placement, or as we used to call it then, pediatrics. And I absolutely loved it. I went into a lab which had gas chromatography, mass spectrometries, it had tandem mass specs. It had people sat on the bench. I don't mean physically sat on the bench, but I mean people stood at the bench manually extracting samples. And there was lots of data interpretation involved in it. And I think I was particularly lucky because at the time I was there, the guy in charge of the lab at the time was Mick Henderson, who was absolutely lovely. I think he realized very quickly that I actually knew very little biochemistry, but he took me under his wing anyway. And I completed my training and looked for a job in metabolic. And to be honest, I've never really looked back.
Well, clearly greed pieces loss is our gain. Not everyone has to go and look at seaweed to get to where you are now. So if you were looking to train to do your role, what training do you need?
Yeah, so I think the training for biochemists has changed quite a lot in the last sort of 5 years, and it's much better advertised now, and I think there's much more PR around it, and it's still a national recruitment program, but essentially you need a BSc in a life science, ideally biochemistry, I guess, but other subjects are acceptable. And you don't need a PhD, but I think a PhD is very helpful because the entry process is very competitive. So a PhD can help to differentiate you from other candidates. The training is still kind of on the job as it was in my day when we referred to it as the Grade A Scientist Training Scheme. But the program's now part of the National School for Healthcare Science. It's a 3-year training program. Known as the scientist training program, and the first year is generic, so you visit different laboratories, so you'll spend some time in hematology, genetics, immunology and biochemistry, and then the second and third years are discipline specific, so you would now spend those in biochemistry. As part of this training, you still do the MSc in clinical biochemistry, and the idea is that at the end of the 3 years you sit an exam known as the objective structured final assessment. And if you pass this successfully, you're able to apply for registration with the Healthcare Profession Council. That qualifies you as a biochemist and enables you to get an entry-level post, which we sort of refer to as a senior clinical scientist post. And then the next step is ideally to get a 5-year higher specialist scientist training post. And then the focus of this is to get you through your FRC path. You also have the opportunity to do a doctorate level qualification if you haven't already done one.
I mean, it sounds like a huge amount of work. I'm not envious at all. But within the podcast, what we're trying to do is to share some of the insight into the workings of the metabolic team and hopefully share the experiences that others can learn from. You've told us perhaps what you do, but when it comes to actually doing it, what does a typical week for a biochemist like yourself look like?
I think every week is different, and I think that's one of the things I like about the job. Essentially, the lab has to run a planned test, if you like, every week. So some tests are done daily, so things like newborn screening, PKU monitoring. Other tests may be run 2 or 3 times a week, and some even less frequently. So we have that, which we just refer to as a routine workload. But we're also, as a lab service, we need to be responsive to the clinical requirements. So for example, this might mean prioritising the analysis of a clinically urgent sample on a specific patient. So it could be somebody who's presented acutely unwell, or it could be one of our known patients who's gone into metabolic crisis. And we then have to basically disrupt what we had planned to do in the lab to make sure we can run that urgent test. We also have to spend quite a lot of time on background activities, if you like, which are all about quality management. So these are things that need to run smoothly in the background to ensure that the tests and the methods that we offer are safe and robust.
I've visited your lab. I know how incredibly passionate you are about how it all works, and that it's awe-inspiring, some of the big machines you've got. What would you say are the parts of the role that interest you the most?
I think I've got particular interests in mass spectrometry and quality improvement, and I guess I'm happiest when I can combine them both. So this is things like developing new tests on the mass spec. It's also important to make sure that the tests that we currently offer remain fit for purpose. And I think sometimes there can be a tendency for lab services to become a little bit complacent, particularly when the assays are complex and manual and you need quite a lot of operator expertise to run them. We have to maintain our routine workload, and it's always a balance between doing that well and having some time to develop and improve the service. I suppose I'm a big advocate that legacy assays can be improved. And I also think it's important that labs take advantage of new technologies.
I mean, it's incredible. And you're saying you can obviously measure lots of things from a single blood spot. So why are you so precious about how much blood we send you on the card?
I think that a good colleague of mine, Stuart Moe, who works in Cardiff, published a paper a few years ago which showed just what impact blood spot quality could have on the actual analytical result that we produce in the lab. So Stuart's paper showed that small spots can give you a negatively biased result, as can spots that have been compressed. So when I say negative bias, I don't mean 1 or 2%, but I mean maybe 20 or 30% bias on what that result should actually be. And likewise, depending on whereabouts you punch the disc of blood from on a given spot, that in itself can introduce a bias. So if you punch at the edge of the spot, you will get a higher result, again, of in the order of 20 to 30% for certain analytes than if you punch in the center of the spot. And so a bias of 20 to 30% could have a big impact on, and it could it ultimately end up in you referring a baby incorrectly, or even worse, not referring a baby that you should have referred. So I think that's why we have in recent years really tried to tighten up on blood spot quality. And I think for me, the interesting thing is that it's all been very focused around the newborn screening program, which is understandable, but most of the screening labs also provide the monitoring service for the known patients. So these are the maple syrup patients and the phenylketonuria patients, and also some of the homocystinurics. And we're measuring these analytes also in blood spots. And the dietitians who look after these patients use those results to decide how effectively that patient's being managed. So obviously when you're looking at the monitoring of a patient, it's the trend in result that's important. So you want your lab to be consistent, and you also want your lab to be accurate. And if the quality of the spot can introduce variation of 20 to 30% for a given analyte, I think it's quite important that we raise awareness about that. So we're not trying to be precious. I appreciate that that's how we may come across, but we're doing it with the best of intentions because we don't want to report results that could ultimately be misleading.
It's obviously a difficult time for those of you working in pathology services in the UK and around the world, but are there any other challenges that you're facing currently?
I think the last year has been particularly tough. I think colleagues working in virology have probably very much taking the brunt of that. Obviously, I'm not talking about the NHS as a whole, but pathology specifically. I think often pathology labs, one of our biggest challenges is probably balancing the provision of the routine service, which will always come first to us because ultimately that's the bit that impacts on the patient. But we have to balance that against our desire to do development to improve services. And I think often it comes down to the financial support that's required. So business cases for new kit can be challenging as well, particularly in some of these specialist areas, because our workload may not always be that high, and specialist tests often tend not to be that cheap to perform because they rely on expert staff, manual sample preparation, etc. It's very different from a routine automated laboratory. I think one of the other areas that most metabolic labs are suffering from a little bit at the moment is recruitment of staff. Because we are specialised and because you need to have FRC path for your general career progression, it can be difficult to recruit people. I think I'm very, very lucky to be working for Viapath, because actually Viapath have been incredibly supportive of my service in recent years. And we now have a really good team of people who are committed to working in metabolic biochemistry.
And I think it's obviously a challenge that some conditions are so rare that we don't always have the right wherewithal to support around them, or it's not going to be consistently in places. The work that you're doing is consistently changing clinical care, affecting outcomes, but you're almost always entirely behind the scenes. Many of the patients will never meet or know anything about you, other than the fact they send cards to you on a weekly basis. And I mean, as far as labs goes, where do you see obviously you're quite tightly regulated into what you can deliver, but what do you see the future holding for sort of lab work within IMD in this country?
I think that I would imagine, say, in the next 5 years, we'll probably see an increasing use of automation, particularly in terms of the pre-analytics of the laboratory. So with some of these specialist manual tests, you know, it may take a member of staff say 5 or 6 hours to take a batch of samples, extract them, do what needs to be done to them before they can be analysed, and they may then be run overnight. And I think maybe one of the other areas I'm keen to see develop would be how we use data. So labs tend to generate data. We generate huge amounts of data. Mass specs generate huge amounts of data. And often we do very little with it. And I think if we think a little bit more outside the box, we could start to think about machine learning and how that might fit in with interpreting biochemical profiles. So I did a proof of concept study with two very clever biochemists from Imperial College a few years ago. And we looked at how machine learning could help with the interpretation of amino acid profiles. And it was only a small study, and it did have certain limitations, but essentially it did show that a machine learning algorithm could probably be as good as your average biochemist in terms of differentiating a normal from a, I don't think this one is normal. So I don't think an algorithm could actually confidently classify the disorder, and the biochemist could focus their time and efforts on those profiles that needed their input, and the more straightforward ones could perhaps be dealt with automatically. Now, obviously, that's a big change. It's a lot of people to get their heads around, and we don't yet know if it would be good enough, but I think it's one of the things I'd like to see explored.
Obviously, we don't want to see you replaced by an artificial intelligence, but I mean, the biochemist is, I mean, why is the biochemist an integral part of the MDT?
I hope we are. It's nice to hear you say we are. I think it's because we don't just do the testing and provide the results. We know the methods inside out, so we know what their limitations are. We should know when something is wrong. We should always also be able to look at an unusual result or an atypical result and understand if it's some kind of weird and wonderful analytical artifact or whether it could be of clinical significance. I guess to do our job well, we have to have a reasonable understanding of the clinical aspects of the disorders that we're testing for. And then hopefully that means we can have sensible discussions with our clinical colleagues. So I always think that the relationship between the lab and the clinician is a really important one. And I think in certain areas like metabolic, I think we demonstrate that quite nicely. And ultimately we don't always know the answer, but we will go and find out.
That's right. I mean, obviously, in an era where we're seeing increasing reliance on genetic tests and very rapid turnaround on genetic testing, the biochemistry is still key to confirming a diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a colleague who's been telling me for the last 5 years that we will no longer be required, and genetic testing is the way forward. I hope he's only pulling my leg, but I do think with some of the weird and wonderful things that genetic testing turns up, the importance of functional testing should never be underestimated. And I think that that's where biochemistry has an important role.
If you were to go back and meet your younger self, what would you like to have kind of learned sooner rather than later?
I think I would say never be afraid to challenge the status quo. Obviously you want to do that in a diplomatic and informed way, but I think that's important. Always challenge the status quo. Don't accept that things can't change. And I think also communication and I guess PR are important. Scientists often aren't terribly good at this, and I think one of the things I've learned from our chief scientific officer is the importance of telling the story behind the science. And it doesn't really matter if this is making a case for a new post or a new piece of equipment, whether you're giving a lecture or lobbying to change national screening policy or set up a new research project. If you can provide the context and explain why what you're doing or what you want to do will benefit the patient, I think you will engage people much better, and you'll have a much better chance of getting your project enabled.
I think it's so important that the patient is at the centre of everything we do. Rachel, thank you so much. I've learned a lot. I hope that the listeners have too. Thank you, Rachel, so much for your time.
No, thank you, James, for inviting me to join the podcast.
Oh, and thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.
To keep up to date with future episodes of the Beat podcast from Nutritia, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, as well as lots of other educational content from Nutritia. Sign up to our newsletter at www.nutritia.co.uk. We'll be right back.